Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for joining me for the 186th edition of New Mainers Speak. This is a weekly half-hour program where you can hear firsthand about the lives of some of Maine's immigrants. During the show, we visit with individuals regarding their life stories and enduring hopes as New Mainers. Today, my guest is James McClay. He's a border guy from a mixed family, born in Derry, Northern Ireland, to parents from Donegal, Ireland, where he was raised. He's always worked with youth and got his undergraduate degree in youth and community work. James came to Maine in 2012 to work for a local service, social service agency. After falling in love and getting married, he enrolled in UNE's School of Social Work and continues to work and serve young people and families in Maine while he studies. This is where our paths crossed, and I'm so glad they did. Thanks for coming on the radio with me, James. Welcome to New Mainers Speak.
Thanks very much. How are you?
I'm good. Now, you guys listening out there can compare James's accent to Anella's. We were just comparing accents in here, and it was kind of fun. So you're from a family of six, two boys, two girls. I wondered if you could tell what an average day in the early 90s looked like at your house when you were a kid. What did your folks do? What did your family do for fun?
In the early 90s? So I have three siblings. I have a younger sister who's 2 years younger than me. But my older brother and sister, my older sister is 8 years older than me, and my older brother's 10 years older than me. So I guess technically they're half siblings. They have a different father, and really it's weird for me to think about that because it just never comes up.
Doesn't feel that way.
So I guess in the early 90s, they were probably off doing their own older teen things. and it was mostly me and my younger sister at home with my mother. So she always did... She'd like a lot of party plan, so you know, different sales, and would do parties in people's homes, so selling everything from ceramics to cosmetics to Avon to lingerie. that was always fun, knowing your friend, having your friends know that that was what your mother was doing. But my father always worked in either construction or agriculture, so he did kind of weird hours, like either be out at first thing in the morning to maybe last thing at night if there was a harvest on, or he might have just been back at 4 or 5 o'clock, depending on the time of year.
What foods might he have been harvesting?
They did fodder beet, which was for feed for the cattle and stuff like that.
Fodder beet?
Yeah, fodder beet. Uh-huh. So like sugar beet. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's very similar to sugar beet, but I really don't know an awful lot about it.
That's cool. Fodder beet. I got it.
But it was a feed. It was a feed for cattle, for animals. Corn, potatoes, obviously.
Duh.
Yep. Definitely. Potatoes, corn. I shouldn't even say good. Barley was another big one. But yeah.
Yeah. So, what did you all do for fun on an afternoon
together? We were very lucky. The early part of in the '90s, we were still living in Derry when my parents were building a house in Donegal. So they were both from Donegal originally, but had moved were renting an apartment in Derry. And then we moved into a slightly larger house that they were still renting, but we were building a house in Donegal, which was only, technically it's across an international border, but it was 4 miles away.
Yeah, it's like Biddeford Saco.
Yeah, so we used to walk there. My mom would pick us up from school times, and we would walk there because at that time there were still checkpoints on the major roadways, so a lot of the back roads over the border were blocked off by these huge, big concrete bollards that we called Dragon's Teeth. So we would walk out the road where they were, and our house was just past that. It took them 12 years to build that house because they didn't borrow any money. They didn't get a mortgage or anything like that. So literally when they had some money, they'd build a little bit more.
You sell a lingerie piece and you buy
a
window.
You know, yeah, exactly. You know, that would be about 3 blocks for a pair of panties or something like that. I can't remember now exactly what the exchange was, but... so we used to do that a lot, but we were very lucky because at that time we were actually living in a council estate in Derry, and a lot of the families that lived around us were either both parents were unemployed or maybe one parent had a part-time job and stuff like that. So both my parents always worked, so we kind of had a little bit more than some of the others around us. We weren't wealthy by any means, or it wouldn't have taken 12 years to build a house.
Right, and they were cobbling together.
Yeah, but we were lucky in the sense that we always did things. Like, we didn't just grow up on the street, and I don't mean on the street as in homeless, but most of my friends played in the street that we lived on, mm-hmm, all day long. A lot of those typical street games, like either soccer, hopscotch, different variations of hide and seek and things like that. But we were always getting taken away to different places and spent a lot of time in Donegal and going on different road trips and things like that. So, you know, I mean, I enjoyed those games and things like that when we were at home, but we were very lucky in the sense that we got to experience something else as well.
And you explained earlier that you're from a mixed marriage, and I wondered if you wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, because it kind of feels silly saying that now. But when I first met my wife, we were obviously trying to get to know each other, and I said that my parents were a mixed marriage. And she's looking at me going, well, you don't look, you know, and she was trying to pick her words correctly because she didn't want to say something offensive or, you know, she's trying to stay PC. But she's like, you don't look like you're mixed race. I'm like, well, no, I mean. And then she was like, well, what do you mean by mixed marriage? And I was explaining that my dad was Protestant and my mother was Catholic.
Which is a big deal.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, most of the people in the neighborhood that we grew up, I mean, those council estates that I was talking about were very segregated. So we grew up in, for all intents and purposes, what's called a Catholic estate or a Irish Republican or Irish Nationalist estate. So wasn't really aware of it when I was younger, but as I was older, I became aware that it wasn't something we advertised, that my dad was a Protestant living in that area. You know, it's something that probably could have responded in the house being targeted or singled out, you know, getting windows broken, things like that. We're very lucky. We had very good neighbors, and I think some of them did probably know, and it was never a huge issue, but it's just something that was always in the back of your mind.
It's so tricky. You know, you're from 4 miles away. How can you be a foreigner?
Yeah.
But, you know, that's in your head, not in your heart.
Well, this is it.
So, did you have any nicknames as a kid?
None that I'm willing to share.
And how many kids were out there playing kick the can?
There was, on our street, we actually had one of the smallest streets in the neighborhood. And it was actually quite a nice street in most ways. It was kind of off to the side. If you were to look at like a map of the neighborhood, we were like right on the line. So our house, the side that our house was on, when we looked like out our kitchen window and stuff, we were looking at fields and rolling hills. We actually have pretty much the exact same view, just from a bit further away than what our house in Donegal has.
Oh, so in Maine.
Well, no.
I know your parents.
Yeah, my
Donegal.
Parents. So if you look out my parents' living room window, you're looking at the same mountain that we would have been looking out our kitchen window in Derry. So, I mean, that gives you an idea of how close it was.
Wow. That's a really kind of beautiful image of strange political borders.
Yeah. And we had a smaller street as well. So we only had about 12 houses on our street, where a lot of the streets would have had 40, 50 and stuff like that. So we were kind of tight-knit in that way.
Yeah.
And a little separated from a lot of the other streets. So, yeah, I loved playing. I loved all the kind of hide-and-seek kind of games where you used to, you know, I always kind of liked playing army and stuff like that, crawling through like the bushes and trees, and we had a lot of trees and things in that area, so we're always like building tree houses, and I loved any excuse to kind of be able to hide in the bush and like stalk somebody. I know it sounds like a creepy night.
It's a kid thing. It's so fun. It's like capture the flag.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's
great. I almost didn't get picked a lot because I was good at it.
Oh, he's trouble. Well, you've always been in community organizations, from Cub Scouts to cross-cultural youth groups. You've also racked up a wide range of jobs on your resume. I wondered if you could highlight some of these for us. I just love the variety.
Some of the jobs?
Yeah.
I've been a DJ. I had a weekly radio show. I also DJed, like, did birthday parties and stuff like that, playing music, and did karaoke. Actually did karaoke with a group called, we were called the Mad Arabs. Probably not very PC these days, but we dressed up, and that was kind of the gimmick that we went for. Our biggest competition was another guy called the Mad Scotsman.
Oh. They're all mad, all those DJs.
Yeah, exactly. I was a milkman. I delivered milk, bottles of milk door to door at 4 a.m., 3 a.m., going around the city, delivering milk. I was a security guard. I was a night watchman at an abandoned school. Since I've been here, I've driven limousines. I taught driver's ed.
Quarry worker?
I was a quarry worker. Yeah, I worked on a quarry, worked for my dad, actually. That was an interesting job. I used to quit every week. Yeah, I quit, and I still hardly even missed even an hour from quitting. We would have an argument maybe on a Friday evening, and I would end up saying, all right, that's it, I quit, I'm done, I'm not going back. And then all that meant was I got a slightly longer lay-in the next morning, and he would let me go, and then he would call up, and he'd be like, hey, yep. I'm like, no, I'm not going to work. I quit yesterday. So he'd give it a few more minutes, and I go, are you going to work? And then I'd always end up being like, aye, all right. And getting up and getting dressed and the tractor, and off I went.
Off you went to work in the tractor. I think this variety of jobs speaks to your adaptability, and sounds like you inherited this from your parents. You're willing to do what it takes to make the bills.
Yeah, that's very much the case. Like, it's just my entire family just has a really strong work ethic, and no real airs or graces about us. We'll do whatever we need to do, you know, and we all just persevere to provide for our families and for ourselves. And
creative and productive. Yeah. And when you were a kid, did you ever imagine you would take your skills on the road and move to the United States, much less Standish, Maine?
There was a part of me that always thought I'd move somewhere, always thought I would probably live somewhere else. And I kind of always knew I wasn't going to end up with someone from my hometown. I don't even know how to explain that, but I always kind of knew I was going to end up with someone from somewhere else. And I don't know why. I honestly can't explain that. It's just a feeling I had in the back of my head. Anytime I was dating somebody from home, it always just felt like, I don't know, it just felt like there was something missing, or that's not, I always had this feeling that I wasn't going to end up with someone from home.
That's pretty cool.
And I always traveled a lot, and being involved in a lot of youth and community organizations, I got the chance to travel quite a bit around Europe. I was very lucky because I got this some awesome travel, and for free, or else I got paid for it. And it was always a cool way to do it as well, because when we'd go to like a town and say, like I've been to Belgium quite a few times, and we were staying in a place called Ypres, and we ended up getting to meet the mayor of Ypres, and we got a tour of the local like government buildings and just things that you don't get to do on a normal vacation, because it's part of this like cross-community exchange. So we kind of get to just see things that not everybody sees on vacation, and you know, you're almost treated like a VIP. You know,
dignitary.
Yeah, and that's just always been a cool way to try. It almost made it disappointing when I kind of just booked my own vacations in.
I know, I'm like, just what you mean.
Yeah, where's the guy waiting with the red carpet to welcome us and introduce us to everybody?
And feel like there's meaning and purpose to your visit.
And I was always traveling with kids too that, for the most part, never would have had a vacation, and you know, their parents wouldn't have been able to afford sending them to some of the countries that we took them to.
Yeah.
And it was just really cool letting them experience something else other than what's on their own doorstep. You know, I honestly think one of the most beneficial and educational things anybody can do is to travel. It's kind of part of, like, I mean, I love what you're doing here with the show. It's just because experiencing other cultures, I think it's just the benefits are never ending. You know, I mean, it really can kind of play into any part of someone's life, you know, from education to employment, you know.
Yeah. How can you know yourself if you don't know the others?
Yeah.
And you don't even know that you're doing a border thing with Protestants and Catholics until you go to Belgium and you realize, oh, it's really different here.
Yeah. You realize
and that's a choice, right? And this is our culture. So can you tell us how you found your way here to Maine? I think that's such an interesting story.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. I'm allowed to mention the name of the organization. I'll see if I can keep it out. I was sitting at home. The job I worked on a project over there called Time Out, for an organization called Extern. And what Time Out was, I would always pick up kids on either a Monday or a Thursday, and I would take them to a residential center. And like our residential center was called Roscoe Youth Village, and it's in County Fermanagh. And it was this beautiful area, like this beautiful campus where we had all these little cottages and then a few bigger buildings that we called our education center, and that had like this beautiful big lodge room with these big leather couches and this big stone fireplace. It was actually like something you'd see in like a cabin in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
It was right on the lake, so we had our own little marina, we had a sailboat and stuff, and we'd take kids to this place and we'd do like different outdoor pursuits and a lot of hill walking, hiking, camping, canoeing, four-wheeling, and sometimes fishing. Like, did a lot of fish. Fishing's a great exercise
like
for
a
social work.
Cool job.
It never felt like work. I did that for 7 or 8 years. It never felt like work. And a big part of it was because of like kind of labor laws and stuff over there. I would do the shift for 4 days before bringing the kids back. And the kind of the big point of it was these would be kids whose home placement was maybe on the brink of breaking down. So we would come in, we'd take them away, and we'd be doing all these fun
like
things.
Almost.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was respite families. For the kids, because I've worked in residential care here in Maine, and I've worked with a lot of kids who've been in the same facility for years without ever spending a single night somewhere else. You know, it's a service I wish actually would come here, because staff and foster parents and stuff are always getting respite, but the kids never get a break from some of the other kids that they're living with or from the facility. So we would give kids respite, but also it was times an opportunity for a social worker to come in and work with the family to try to put out the immediate fire, to extend that placement to allow us to do kind of more long-term work. So we'd be doing fun things and things like that, but it was kind of that idea of keeping kids in flow. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not really thinking about all the stresses and worries of the world when you're focused on fishing or canoeing or and stuff like that.
It's a distraction and learning some real life skills.
Well, exactly, because we do budgeting and stuff. One of the first things we do when we get there is like, right, we gotta eat the next 4 days. And they would do the plan for what we're going to eat and how much money we had and what we could afford and what we'd have to sacrifice to be able to get something else and things like that. And there was always an underlying if aggression was the issue or other behavioral problems, we'd be tackling that along the way. It just wasn't, I guess it was a little sneaky. We were kind of getting these things in subtly, you know what I mean? The kids weren't realizing that we were kind of doing work with them, but it's some of the most effective work I've ever done.
That's called effective parenting.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful.
But it allowed me a lot of time off also. So I'd do 4 days on, and then I'd have 3 or 4 days off, and then every month I had like about a week or so off. So I was sitting at home and killing time, and my mom called me up. She saw an ad in the local paper, and it was, consider the United States, consider Maine.
So you were being recruited from a social service agency in Maine.
Yeah.
You were in Northern Ireland or Ireland at the time?
I was in Northern Ireland. I was living in Derry, actually. As soon as when I hit 18, I wanted my own place, wanted my own apartment, and moved straight back into Derry.
So I think this is so interesting. I think, you know, when we talk about immigrants in Maine all the time, I don't think we realize we're recruiting.
Yeah.
We're recruiting immigrants.
Yeah, they were like, the agency I was working for, they had been recruiting a lot of people from Canada, and then there were several people from Ireland.
Foster parents.
Yeah, to be therapeutic foster parents. Mm-hmm. And I actually met a guy online. I didn't meet him online. It was a guy I knew that I went to university with that did youth and community work along with me. And I saw him on Facebook and saw that he was live. And I remember meeting him out in the town one night, and he was like, oh, I'm moving to the States tomorrow. And when I got here, I reached out to him and was like, hey, I'm moving to the States. He was like, where are you moving to? He was like, I'm moving to Maine. And it turned out he was here doing the exact same job.
Nice. So you both answered the same ad, basically.
Yeah.
Well, so glad you did. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to New Mainers Speak. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is James McClay. Not only is he a graduate student at the School of Social Work at UNE, but he continues to work with youth here in Maine while he's at it. And like lots of Mainers, he and his wife have a side business, but theirs is quite unique. It is a pop-up inflatable pub, Irish style, to go. So, James, you just have to tell us about your inflatable business to help people picture what it is you offer if they haven't already seen your show, your pub on Facebook. I linked to this show.
Yeah. So I'm one of these people, I can't switch off. I'm always kind of thinking, you know, and I've always kind of wanted to start my own business, and I wanted something to be almost therapeutic for me, something that's fun that I enjoy doing. And I always liked DJing and doing karaoke and parties like that, but I came across this thing. Came across it 4 or 5 years ago, these inflatable pubs, and I just thought it was the coolest idea. You know, it's almost like a bounce house for kids, you've got a bounce house for kids, but it's like a bounce house for adults. Without the bounce.
With the bouncer.
You get a bouncer, you don't get the bounce in it. But yeah, basically it's a 33 foot long by 16 and a half foot high, old, rustic looking Irish pub that we bring to your house. We inflate it. We've done graduation parties, birthday parties, engagement parties, and, you know, pick your own clothes and hours. Why you worry about trying to make your way to a pub or get everybody to meet up somewhere, you know?
You'd have it right
in your backyard.
It's so cool. It actually doesn't look inflatable. It looks like a log cabin online.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't imagine how much fun that is.
Yeah, people are always thanking us. Like, when I go to pick it up, that's what's been craziest to me. It's like blowing my mind is people come and thanking us like I did them a favor. You know, I'm like, well, you paid for it, you know. I'm just providing this service.
Yeah, so basically when people are going to hire a canopy, if you're going to be having like a pub, it has sides and everything. So
you can
just have it all sides, inside.
Got front, and door, back door, front door, back door. You know, we've got these big rustic wooden whiskey barrels and set it up like that. It's crazy. It looks pretty nice. And my biggest goal is to set it up in such a way and create an atmosphere that has people forget that they're an inflatable. You know, I want people to think they are in their own pub. And the sign, you get your own customized signs, or you get the name of the pub, and the sign above the door is your pub name. Like, we have a sign that says McClay's, you know, and people, the last people we booked out to, they used like a play on words with Rera Irish Pub, but they kind of changed all the spelling. It was like a private joke for them, but, you know, it's really cool that people get, and they keep the sign, and we leave the sign with you so that you've got that as a memento.
Oh, that's fun. That's so fun. Here's to more fun.
Big time.
So You've become invested in the local Irish groups as well, the yep. Irish Heritage Center and the Irish American Club. And when we met before, you said that there are six times more Irish here in the United States than there are in Ireland, with about 35 or 40 million Americans who are descendants from those who left in the famine/genocide. Do you think Irish American people have compassion for today's world refugee crisis?
This is one of those questions I have to answer very carefully. I think some people do. I do know a lot of people that do. But I'm constantly coming up against a segment of that community that don't. And almost, I'll give you a prime example. Bill O'Reilly's in Ireland at the minute, or he was just in Ireland very recently. And he's traveling around. He's in County Cavan, where his family came from. And, of course, he's tweeting, and he's like, in County Cavan, where my family were evicted in 1845 during the famine, this is why I don't believe in white privilege. You know, and I'm like, you're completely missing the point. He's kind of comparing it to this, because my family, something bad happened in the 1800s, then we're not susceptible to privilege at all. But there's so many times in history where the oppressed become the oppressors, and instead of using it as an excuse for, I don't know, being able to do anything you want, people are like, we came from hardship, so we're not doing anything wrong, and everybody else should do. I think people forget some of the help that they might have got when they were going through those hardships, and everybody likes to think that they've done it on their own, you know, and they've never stood on anybody's shoulders, you know. And I think what we should be doing is reflecting on that time and looking at those "No Irish Need Apply" signs that were up everywhere. You know, the Irish were treated exactly like the Muslim refugees that have been coming recently, if not worse. You know, there was people waiting at the docks to try to put them back on boats. You know, the know-nothings, and if you watch like gangs in New York, you know, I mean, obviously it's an exaggerated telling of that story, but there's a lot of accurate information in there as well. You know, we should be reflecting on that and making sure we don't make the same mistakes that those people who were oppressing us made.
Being raised in the United States, I can assure you I got very little history of any other cultures. You said something about the famine not being totally accidental, but more of a genocide, and I wondered if you could flesh that out a little bit.
Well, I guess the simplest way to say it is, do you really think missing one crop, you know, just not having potatoes is going to wipe out an entire people? You know, it just doesn't add up when you look at the evidence. Is overwhelming that there was food in the country. There was food being shipped out of the country to the United Kingdom, to wealthy landlords and things like that. It wasn't that there was no food. There was a potato blight that harmed the crop, but it didn't wipe out the crop for all those years that the famine lasted. There's a lot of evidence. Quinnipiac has a fantastic famine exhibition, or they call it the Great Hunger exhibition. It's often now referred to as the Great Hunger here in the United States, because people have realized that it wasn't a famine in the true sense of the word, that there was no crop and no food. There was food, but the food was being sifted out of the hands of the poor into the hands of the wealthy.
It reminds me of the large agribusinesses raising crops in places where people really are starving, and they're fenced off, and they're starving people on one side of a field and a field full of food in the other side. So we can have food and not be able to have access to it.
Yeah, I mean, you look at a lot of farmers out in the Midwest at the minute that are just caught in this like endless cycle of they're being given more restrictions and more limitations by the companies that they're employed by. So they have to then get into more debt to meet the regulations or the expectations of these huge corporations. So they can't get their head above water, you know. So they're farming and growing and growing and making other people wealthy while they end up going without and getting themselves deeper and deeper in debt.
Yeah. And you showed me the other day you have a very special ring from your birth town of Derry, or Londonderry. And it has a symbol for all the different pieces of time through Londonderry history. And one of them is a ship. And it's to remember all the people that emigrated out of Ireland. And it caused me to have a little paradigm shift, you know, being an American. I think of people that I meet that identify as Irish, even though my name sounds Irish. I'm not. It just never really occurred to me in just that way what it would be like to have your community bled of people. And the way you must think about the United States must be kind of the counter of the way Americans think about Ireland as the homeland. You know, you must think that your people are here.
Say it again.
So, do people in Ireland think of the United States as where a lot of their cousins and brothers and uncles went?
Probably at a time. I don't think currently that people think too much about it. And honestly, I think a lot of the immigrating population, because there still has been, especially after the most recent recession, immigration numbers in Ireland skyrocketed again. But Australia kind of became the popular destination over. The United States is still very popular, but there's been more and more immigrating to Australia.
Yeah.
You know, but there's definitely, I mean, there's always been a huge connection between the United States and Ireland. And I think a lot of people in Ireland still very much see America as that land of opportunity and still have an affinity for America, even though there might be a lot of things going on at the minute that are souring some people's opinions. Which is so sad, you know. It's really, really sad that what the image that's being put out there is what people are thinking of now.
Yeah, I think tourism seems like it's down.
Yeah.
And I think the less Canadians are coming down. So, James, you have poured your life into helping youth on two continents. You care about finding the middle path in difficult situations, and you bring your joy with you like an inflatable pub party. So thank you so much for being my guest today, and thank you.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kate Manahan, closing today's program with a song that James has selected for us. Can you quickly tell people why you chose this song?
I've always loved this band, but most recently, as a social worker, this has kind of become my anthem. And when I'm sort of struggling, this is kind of a song that I listen to quite regularly when I'm driving around, because the chorus is, "How can I protect you in this crazy world?" And I don't know, it just kind of it kind of zones me out a little bit when I listen to this, because that's a thing I'm kind of constantly asking myself, is how do I protect people as there's more and more challenges being put in front of me.
Thank you.
Time.